This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one man band. I'm the number one fan. Me and my 88.
Welcome to episode 175 of our podcast, Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. I have in my hand here an object. I'm going to shake it. This is an invention called a cassette. I've done 10 projects in my life, but one of them was a cassette of worship songs. I was a pastor for about 16 years in the 80s and early 90s. And during that time, I didn't do a lot of concerts or things like that. Most of the songs I wrote were songs that we could sing in church. So we made this little tape in a guy's basement. And I want to play songs that were written during that time because our guest was a member of our church during that time. And the first song is a cutoff of this cassette called Let Me Worship You Today.
This is holy ground where I'm standing. I linger here worshiping you. As I linger here worshiping you. As I linger here worshiping you.
I couldn't sleep a few nights ago, and I took the advice of a friend who wrote one time and said that when she had insomnia, she would just go listen to previous episodes of Me and My 88 Friends. So I did that the other night, and I listened to a testimony of a person who used to go to our church when I was a pastor, and it moved me just like it moved me the first time. So I want to replay it for you. This was episode 75, but it's from our friend Sue Stewart Davis. Sue has worked for a number of years with women in prison. She has taught them, and now she's involved in helping them get on their feet once they're released. So it's a great joy to go and hear Sue's great testimony one more time. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning, Lawrence.
I'm so glad you're on the show this week.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've got a wonderful testimony, and I'm looking forward to this. I'm trying to think when we met. I was your pastor for a few years.
Yes, you were.
One of your pastors. We had two pastors there.
Yeah.
Don Weitzel was the other one.
Don Weitzel. I think about late 89 to 90 is when I started going, and got really, really involved at that church. I mean, I went to women's prayer groups, our life group, our small group every Friday night. A bunch of small families all bring their kids. And, you know, I volunteered at a crisis pregnancy center in Clinton, and I worked at a food bank and prayer groups and Bible studies. And
those were great days. They really were.
It was.
Just so our audience knows, we didn't have a fancy building. We met in a gymnasium.
Yep.
It was the Marlboro Girls Club. We never owned a building, but that didn't keep us from worshiping and learning the word. So you
Absolutely.
Came there late 80s, and you came because some friends invited you, right?
Right. Yep. My husband was playing softball with one of the men who went to church there, and his family we met at the ball field all the time and started getting close, and they invited us.
So I'm just curious, what did you think when you first walked in there? I'm going to church, and you walk in there, and the pulpit's under a basketball hoop.
Initially, it wasn't that much of a surprise. I had been going to a church before that in Acton that was, it was a spirit-filled church. So I was already familiar with the worship styles and the music and stuff like that. But the music we sang, though, your music, your praise, some of the ones that you wrote, I mean, touched my heart like nothing else. I mean, just pierced my heart. And it was like every song we sang and every song we learned dug deeper and deeper to my heart. And I started having encounters. Some real encounters with God. But at that point, it was kind of still up in my head. I knew God loved me in my head, but it hadn't hit my heart yet. And I didn't have anything real personal going on with Jesus yet. But I was going.
I had been in a couple of bands and had written a lot of songs. But during that phase, when we just kind of laid everything down and just concentrated on the church, basically, all I wrote were most of what I wrote were praise and worship songs, so we tried them out on the church. Are there any songs in particular you remember from back then that really spoke to you?
There was one, and the weeping turned to joy when the
what a happy happy day.
What a happy, happy day when the tears are wiped away and the weeping turns into joy.
Well, I never sing that song now, but little kids that grew up during that time, they love that song. So
yes.
I'm actually going to stop right now and play that song off of an ancient tape that I did, What a Happy, Happy Day.
There was
laughter, lots of laughter, when Sarah gave birth to Isaac. There was joy, shouts of joy, when Sarah received her son. Father Abraham looked upon him. He could hardly believe his eyes. What a happy, happy day when the tears were wiped away and the weeping turned into joy. There was laughter, lots of laughter, when the Red Sea came crashing down. Joy, shouts of joy, you know they made a mighty sound. There was singing, there was dancing, they could hardly believe their eyes. What a happy, happy day when the tears were wiped away and the weeping turned into joy. Joy cometh in the morning, and they that sow in tears shall reap with a shout of joy. There was laughter, lots of laughter, when the ark was brought to town. There was joy, great shouts of joy, could hear them for miles around. King David danced with all his might. He could hardly believe his eyes. What a happy, happy day when the tears were wiped away and the weeping turned into joy. There was laughter, lots of laughter, when those captive years were through. There was joy, shouts of joy, when Mount Zion came into view. Oh, and they were like those who dreamed. They could hardly believe their eyes. What a happy, happy day when the tears were wiped away and the weeping turned in.
Are wiped away. the weeping turns into joy. What a happy, happy day when the tears are wiped away and the weeping turns into joy. What a happy, happy day when the tears are wiped away and the weeping turns into joy. What a happy, happy day when the tears are wiped away and the weeping turns into joy.
Another song that I wrote, which we're starting to sing again after all these years, is a song called Send the Rain. And I want to play that in a few minutes. Do you remember that song, Send the Rain?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
That song was written, actually, that was the early days of Ray Bolts, and he had come to town, and we had a sort of a prayer chain going on during the concert. Somebody would go out of the building and pray for 20 minutes or half an hour. And so somebody was praying the whole time. And so my slot came up and I went up to my office. Again, it was at the Marlboro Girls Club. We had an office over in the other part of the building.
Yep.
And I was up on the third floor looking over the parking lot, and it started raining. Just started raining. And a verse came to my mind about let your righteousness rain down. It's in Isaiah. And so that's how that song was written. We sang it a lot during those years. I'm going to play this song. I'm going to play it, Send the Rain, now, and then we're going to talk.
Okay.
Thank you. Salvation, there it's true. Lord, we're living in a dry and thirsty land. So we ask you once again, send the rain.
I'm back with my special guest, Susan Stewart Davis, or Sue. I call her Sue.
Either or is fine.
Great. Sue was a member of our church during my pastoring years in Marlborough, Massachusetts. So, Sue, you came to that church and you played ball. I think you played ball with my wife, Trish.
Yeah, well, actually, I helped her actually too when she was coaching track.
That's right.
She knew that I held records in track in high school, and she knew I high jumped, and she wanted me to help show the kids how to high jump. So I did that, and the first time I did that, I broke my ankle, and I was on crutches for a while.
Okay, now that was what, 30 years ago? Can you still jump now?
No.
I can't even low jump. So anyway, Trish and I moved south in 1994, and I lost contact with you. And then one day, I forget what year it was, I got a letter from you.
Yep, 1994.
Was it 94? And
yep.
I had no idea what had come of you. That just happens sometimes when you move away and you're busy making changes and all. But this letter really moved me to my core. I wanted you just to tell your story at this point.
Okay. The first major thing that happened in my life that changed it was I was a junior in high school and I got in a really bad automobile accident, and I was heading to a school dance with three other girls in the car. It was one of those big old station wagons with the wood down the side. And it had been raining that night or during that day. And we were in one of those old country roads and we're heading down the hill and we hydroplaned a puddle and hit the tree. And when we did that, my head flew forward and got wedged in between the front door and the seat in the front door. Mm. And I was immediately comatose. And the other two of the other women, girls with me, they wound up in body casts and traction for months and months. My best friend, the way we were kind of stationed in the part that she was in front of, just kind of molded around her body, and she just got some cuts. But I was in a coma. I was in Emerson Hospital in Concord, Massachusetts. And after 3 days being in a coma, the doctors were telling my parents, "We don't know. We don't know what kind of brain capacity she's going to have when she gets out of this. We just don't know." So no one was allowed to come in and see me. I was in ICU except for family. And then after 4.5 days, they allowed my best friend, who was the other girl who just got the cuts. She came in to visit her sister, who was in body cast and traction, and our other friend. And they let her in. And my mother told her, "Listen, she can hear you. She may not respond, but she can hear you." Because I guess at that time, I was starting to like squeeze somebody's hand. They told me to squeeze their hand, right, but I just couldn't wake up. So she went in, my mom told her, "Ask her questions. Ask her questions. Remind her of stuff." So she came in and she started asking me questions. And she asked me personal stuff, things that we just had in common. And then she asked me about my favorite stuffed animal's name. And I opened my eyes and I looked up and I looked at her and I said, boom, boom. And I woke up, and then at that point had to get brain scans, going back and forth to different hospitals, whatever. But then at one point, after like a couple of weeks, my mom was like, I'm taking her home. So I was still kind of like a kid. I really couldn't understand things very well, but I was home for a little while, and my best friend would come to visit me, and we would play Monopoly, and it was always my turn. Yeah. I didn't know enough to give her a turn. And my mom was like, okay, we're going to put her back into school. She needs to have more stimulation. We're going to put her back into school. So I got back into school, had no idea what my classes were, where my classes were, how to get to my classes, but I had other people from my classes that would kind of corral me and lead me to where I needed to be. But none of my teachers called on me because they knew I wouldn't be able to answer the questions. But after a couple of weeks, I was sitting in chemistry class and we were listening to a lecture. And the two teachers in front were talking about some kind of chemical compound thing, whatever. And I could just almost grasp what they were trying to say. And so I waited to the end of the lecture and I went down to the bottom, you know, where they were at the end. I said, listen, I can almost understand what you're saying. Can you try to drill this concept into my head? And so we sat there down there till the end of the period until I could understand what they were saying. And from that point on, I was able to start learning again. And then it kind of changed my life. Up until that point, I was in cheerleading. I was in gymnastics. I was in track. I was in drama. And then something just snapped. Something just in my head. I don't know. The only thing I can think of is that basically in my head, I started telling myself, you could die tomorrow. Live it up today. So by my, you know, beginning of my senior year, I quit everything. No more cheerleading, no more track, no more nothing. And I just started hanging out with the party people. And wow. Then, yeah, the end of my senior year, I met who was to be my first husband. His parents moved to New York. We wound up moving to New York together. We got married at 19. I had my daughter at 20. By the time I was 21, we were separated. And then I moved back to, my parents had moved to New Hampshire. So I moved to New Hampshire when I was just like 21, 22. And this is when I want to stop saying the times in my life when I would start going off the rails, when my drinking would really, really escalate, were the times that I didn't have a man in my life. Because I was so broken and I never felt whole. I never felt complete with me because I didn't like being with me. So things escalated, whatever. And I wound up moving from New Hampshire back to Acton, Mass, which is where I graduated from high school. You know, I still was that, you know, I had so much brokenness, so much emptiness, no peace at all going on in my life. It was 1984. I got arrested for my first DUI.
Can I butt in here? During that time, the party years and all, did you ever think about God, or was he kind of way back in the back of your mind?
No, I didn't. I grew up in a church. It was church was a social thing. Yeah, I didn't know God at all.
Okay, and you didn't really have a real background in it, so
not at all.
Okay,
not at all.
All right, keep going.
Okay, so I moved to New Hampshire. Oh, I'm sorry. I moved back to Massachusetts in 1984. I was arrested for my first DUI. And at that time, I lost my license for 30 days. Had to go to classes, had to go to AA meetings. I think I managed to stay sober for maybe 3 months or whatever. But at that time, I just couldn't imagine my life. Like, how are you going to go out dancing and not drink? How are you going to go to a picnic and not drink? How are you going to go fishing? And, you know, I just couldn't imagine it. So I wasn't capable. Plus, I was still broken and it did ease pain. I did learn that it would take pain away temporarily. Unfortunately, the next day, I had more things, guilt and shame built up over what I did the night before. So I had to drink more. And then I wound up, was in a relationship for about almost 2 years. And then that broke up, and I wound up 1986, got my second DUI, and I lost my license for a year. I went to a program called Dual for 2 weeks. It was like a in-house thing. And I think I stayed sober for a little while, but not a long time. And I was in and out of all kinds of crazy relationships, trying to fill that emptiness inside me, which I know now God created, because he's the only one who will fill it. And he needs you to invite him in. But I was trying to fill it up with everything possible that I could to make me feel complete. And nothing worked. But time rolled on, and I met the man, my second husband, who I wound up going to Marlboro Christian Fellowship with.
Yes.
And things went good. I mean, there was actually a point of time there that we were going there, and we were just so involved with so many different things in church. And I think I didn't drink for like almost a year, and I didn't miss it at all. And then things started going downhill. He got a knee injury, and he was out of work, and he had to have surgeries and stuff like that. And just some crazy things started happening. And so what happened was we wound up getting separated and divorced. And then I moved temporarily. I mean, I thought, well, okay, God, I had been talking to my daughter's father again, who was still out in New York. So I'm like, oh, God probably wants me to get back together with my daughter's father. So I go out there. I'm out there for 2 weeks. Whoops, big mistake. This isn't going to work. And at that period of time is when it spiraled. I've spiraled out of control like you would not believe. I was living in, I met some people at a church at a Bible college that actually set me up with a little apartment at the Bible college. But I left my daughter. She really wanted to stay with her dad because she hadn't seen her dad or had any contact with her dad. She was in like fifth grade. And at this time she hadn't seen him since she was a baby. So, it was really hard on her. I mean, to this day, I have never seen her cry so hard before or after that day that I told her, this isn't going to work. We got to move. Cause she wanted us to be a family, and it killed me that I was putting her through this turmoil and these tears in it. So of course, the only way I knew how to really bury that was to drink more. And during the time, but at the same time, I was like, I have to stay here because I'm not going to uproot her in the middle of a class year again. So I'll wait to the end of the year and then go back to Massachusetts.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yeah.
The emptiness and the brokenness you felt all the way back, was your whole self-image based around?
I had nothing.
What was it based around? Your ability to have a relationship, a yep. romantic relationship. And
yes.
so that, and you
exactly.
felt, and the shame and all that was, gosh, I can't even make this work.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what it was. Low self-image, low self-esteem, like you would not believe. But I didn't really understand that till later.
Yeah.
Till much later. But yeah, so we wound up staying there and then moved back to Massachusetts. When we moved back to Massachusetts, a couple weeks later was 4th of July weekend. So we went up to my parents' camps in New Hampshire. We were out sitting by the fire, my brother and I, and I put my daughter to bed and he put his daughters to bed. And we just sat out talking by the fireplace. And then we saw that there was this party going on this little island in the middle of the lake. So we decided to go over there. And I met a guy with the same last name as me. So I married him. So that was, of course, not going to work. I mean, number one, I was 31. He was 22. Another thing is I had no business being in a relationship. I had no business being in a relationship with anybody. Right. So, and that's another. Okay. So this is 1993 and things are going up and down and up and down and crazy. And I was arrested for my third DUI. But at that time, all your convictions spanned over a 7-year span of time. And because it was over a 7-year span of time, my third offense got treated as a first offense. So I lost my license for 90 days, had to go back to classes, that kind of thing. And I think I stayed sober for a couple months, whatever. But life was a mess. I was a mess. No longer involved in any kind of church. No longer hearing from God at all. No longer reading the word. Had no more contact at all with my support system, my friends who were there had been there to lift me up. And that's the same thing as what happened out in New York. You know, I didn't have those real close friends. So, yeah, 1993, I got over that hump. And then July 17th, 1994, my daughter got invited to a sleepover. And the first thing that hit my brain was, okay, party time. But I got a warning. God actually gave me a, like, one of the biggest warnings you could believe. I was like, I dropped my daughter off. I had come back to the house and I was going real fast from my bedroom to the bathroom. And my refrigerator had been leaking at that time. So like there was like a wet on the floor. I slipped on the floor. My foot went underneath the refrigerator and got this huge gash in my foot. Blood everywhere. I mean, I couldn't stop the blood for a long time. But I was at that time, it was like, I can't stay home. I can't stay home with me. I'm going to go out anyways. And
so you didn't like to be alone at all, right?
No. Oh, I did not want to be with me. Even when I went out, I couldn't just go to one person's house for a party. I had to go to another party, then to a bar, then into I was never satisfied. I had to go from one place to another, trying to find more people to talk to, trying to have more fun. So I was out and about, and that's when I got arrested for my fourth DUI. But at that time, I thought, oh, no, I'm just going to go back to the dual program for 2 weeks, whatever. But I'm in the police station, and...
And is this in Massachusetts?
This is in Littleton, Massachusetts. I am being a jerk. I'm saying all kinds of stupid things to these police, and they got fed up. And so they started joking around about how much fun I was going to have in prison. And I'm like, no. I'm not going to prison. I'm just going back to dual for 2 weeks. And they're like, oh, you didn't hear about the new law that was just passed 17 days ago, spanning your arrest record over a 10-year span of time instead of 7. So all my convictions that had fallen off were right back on. So I got scared. I got really scared. And I got a friend to bail me out. They told me, don't drive. Your license has been pulled. I went. They had them drop me off at my car, drove my car back home. The next day, I called my old boss that I worked for in Fitchburg, who was a lawyer and who got me out of my third. And he said, yeah, Sue, you did it this time. You're going to do some time. He said, I probably can get you out in 3 months, 6 months max, but you're going to do some time. And I was just, you know, at that point in time, I was like, I was always able to hold things together. I had been in and out of all kinds of junk, but I was always able to hold life together. But I couldn't figure out. How am I going to hold life together being MIA for 3 months? Because I wasn't even thinking 6. I was thinking 3. But how am I going to hold life together being MIA for 3 months? What am I going to do about my daughter? What am I going to do about my dog? What am I going to do about my apartment? What am I going to do? And it was that point when I couldn't figure things out anymore. And I knew I had no control. I was in control of anything anymore. I waved that white flag and I said, God, you take it. You take it. Take everything, Lord. You take my life, you take my heart, you take my daughter, take my dog, take everything. It's all yours, because deep down inside, even though I didn't know him like I know him now, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he loved me more than anybody loved me, and he wanted better for me than I could ever begin to want for myself. So I had this peace. I had this peace like I never, ever had before, that regardless of what happened, it was going to be okay. He was going to make it okay.
And this was before you went to jail, right?
This is the day before I was due for court.
Oh, boy. Okay.
July 16th, the day before court. July 17th, the next day, my mom took me to court. The judge gave me a 2-year sentence, 1 year mandatory. I didn't break down until I turned around and I looked at my mom. And the tears were rolling down her face, and the pain that I knew I caused, it just killed me. It killed me. And I started thinking about my daughter and what are her friends going to, she's going to have to tell her friends. And it was just so awful. But God kept me in his peace. He kept me in this peace bubble that just rescued me from everything. And I knew everything was going to be okay. Even when they brought me to Framingham State Prison, and they closed that big, huge metal door behind me. I was sad. I was upset, but I still had that peace. And during the course of the time I was there, I was only there for a few days when the intake officer called me and she said, listen, you know, settle in. You're going to be here for at least 3 months because where you're going, where, you know, people who have DUIs go to Longwood Treatment Center. The list is a mile long and it's going to be at least 3 months till you get in. And that was like a minimum security where it was all education and stuff like that. But that was my biggest eye opening to what could be. At that time in 1994, I didn't know that heroin was such a big thing. A huge, huge portion of the women that were there at that prison were there directly or indirectly due to heroin. And I had never seen anybody personally coming off of heroin. And my roommate had full-blown AIDS, and she had just come from the detox center. And you multiply my worst hangover by 100, and this is that's what these girls were going through. And I just felt so bad. I felt so, so bad for them. I'd be praying all the time. I would go to the cafeteria with her, and one of the things is that she like really, really craving sweets. They really, really crave sweets. So we would go to the cafeteria. I'm like, here, take my cookies. Just felt so bad for them. But after 2 weeks, they called my name. They said, pack it up. You're leaving today. So I wound up doing the bulk of my 1 year sentence at a place called Longwood Treatment Center, which, you know, God knew exactly what he's doing sending me there. It was substance abuse education classes every morning, every afternoon, group counseling every day, NA meetings every day. And I listened up really, really close because for the first time in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was life or death for me. I just knew it. It was life or death for me. After I was there for a couple of days, I was told that I needed to write a history. You know, the people around me, theirs was like 1, 2, 3 pages long. Mine was 12. So I got up with a counselor. Yeah. And it was supposed to be all the most important, impactful things in your life that happened. And so I met with my counselor and she started asking me questions like, so what were you feeling when this happened in your life? And how did you feel when this happened in your life? And honestly, I had no answer. I just sat there and I looked at her and I had no answer. And it really, really bothered me. So at that point in time, you know, in this, I had it was like a dorm room style. It was like, I think it was like 7 of us in this dorm room thing. And at nighttime, I was like, God, why don't I know what I feel? I don't understand why I don't know what I feel. And then what happened that night, you know, changed me forever. And basically from like 9 o'clock at night till 3 o'clock in the morning, God just started revealing to me things and things that I should have known, but it was kind of like, the only way I can explain it is that you're in a house with all the shades all pulled and he just kept opening them. And I was just so overwhelmed at the fact that God loved me so much. He was showing me these things about myself that I didn't know. He spoke to me and the first thing he said that, you know, just made me start weeping was, the reason you were such a show off all your life isn't because you thought you were something wonderful. It's because you didn't like yourself at all. You had such low self-esteem, low self-image that was like compensating. And then, you know, I'm like bawling my eyes out. I had to go to the bathroom because I'm weeping and weeping. Not just for the fact that this is something he's telling me that I need to know that I didn't know before, but just the overwhelming love that I felt that he was actually right there with me, right, revealing to me. He was right there with me.
Were you in a room alone or were there other people?
No, there was seven other women. It was all bunks.
So but it was, while it, all but those it, people were around, you were having this one-on-one encounter.
It was unbelievable.
For several hours.
Yeah. And after I recovered from that one thing that he revealed to me, the next thing he revealed to me was, you've sabotaged all your relationships in your life because you never felt worthy of any of their love. I didn't know that. So, of course, I'm weeping and bawling again. And it took me at least an hour to get over that. And then the next thing that he revealed to me is that I never felt worthy of anybody's love because I never felt worthy of my father's love because I didn't get the affection and attention from him that I needed. So, of course, that set me off into another hour of blubbering, just crying and weeping and crying and weeping. And then after I got over that, and I don't tell this to a lot of people, the next thing he did was he held me and he rocked me like a baby. And he said, I love you. You're precious to me. And I've never been the same. I've never been the same after that night. I had never experienced such love before. I mean, I had been married 3 times. I had been in so many relationships. I had never, ever in my life experienced such love. It was just blowing me away. And as a result of that, I was just like, okay, God, take me, bend me, whatever you want to do, but I'm yours. I'm yours. I belong to you. And I came to the point where I was finally, this is life or death for me. This is life or death. And I don't want to die. I'm going to be there someday to see my daughter graduate from high school. I want to be there someday to, you know, see her get married. So I listened up really, really carefully.
That's an incredible story. Was this the first time, I know that you would experience the Lord back when we were all going to church together, but was this the first time you actually came to that point of surrender where it wasn't just, Lord, I'm going to worship you, but hey, here's my whole life?
Yep, it was.
That makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
It was. I was, and like I said, I was madly in love for the first time in my life. And, you know, after that, you know, even though I was incarcerated, I was experiencing a freedom that I had never experienced before, a level of freedom that I had never experienced before. And here I was incarcerated, and a joy that I'd never experienced before, and peace. Not to say it wasn't painful, because I mean, there were times where I felt like I was a big piece of granite or something being chipped away, big chunks of me being taken out, because God knew it wasn't just alcohol that needed to be removed from my life. Okay. I was suffering from bitterness and anger and resentment and low self-esteem and low self-image and abandonment issues, all this stuff that needed to be gone too, in order for him, for me to be whole and for him to be able to mold me into who he created me to be. So I did have some painful times. He was really teaching me and really showing me things, but just so lovingly too. But I, you know, it was painful, but a lot of good things happened. You know, I wound up talking about God all the time. After I finished the initial program, I got sent into a work release at a hospital where the chaplain gave me all these different books and all these different devotionals. I had like a stack. The place I was at was actually, you know, co-ed. All the guys were on the top two floors and all the women were on the bottom. We actually kind of met for groups and classes and stuff like that. I was talking about him all the time, everywhere I was at, because everything was about God. Everything that was happening to me was about God. Everything that God was doing in and through me. And so I just wanted to talk about it all the time, which didn't go over very well in a jail. But but I remember one thing I just kept saying, you know, God, even though I have a mandatory sentence, I know you could get me out of here just like that if you wanted to. But he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly I needed every single minute of that year in order for him to prepare me for what he had for me afterwards.
So you were there an entire year?
Yes, I was there. Yep. Entire year. Basically towards the end of my sentence. A new person came in, and I can't remember how we started talking, but he had a Lawrence tuning cassette.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And
In the jail.
And he got it from somebody, because we were allowed to have Walkmans.
Well, you know, I'm not really a household word, if you know what I mean.
But I can't remember what the name of the cassette was, but he had one.
Well, I only made one cassette. The rest of them were vinyl. It was a cassette.
It was the cassette. He had a cassette, and I had a Walkman, and we started talking, and he let me borrow it, and I played it over and over and over again, and I cried and I cried and I cried.
Well, that cassette was called Let Me Worship You Today, and it had Send the Rain on it. It had What a Happy Day, Let Me Worship You Today, Welcome to New England. But how in the world, and this was in the state of Massachusetts?
Yeah, this was, and like I said, this was minimum security. So
the guy was walking around with a Lawrence tuning cassette, huh?
Yeah.
Did he believe you when you told him that used to be my pastor?
Yes. Yes, and he let me borrow it. Actually, you know, I think I noticed it the first time because we were we had yard time, and we had yard time together. The girls were supposed to stay except from the guys, but the guards kind of gave me some leeway because I wasn't trying to get in a relationship with anybody, because for the first time in my life, I didn't have to have a guy in my life. And that was almost as freeing as not in being as being set free from alcohol.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he let me borrow this. And yeah, I just thought that was just so cool. And
I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah, I think what happened was a friend of his, or maybe it was his brother, had been to a coffee house, had seen you, had got a cassette, and had given it to him when he was in jail. I think that's how we wound up with it.
That is so incredible.
I did wind up with it. But
that is so incredible, because you even like this show. You do it, and you don't know if anybody's listening or whatever. And to hear that tape got wiggled into a prison and got.
You know what? It really isn't that big of a surprise. You know, from what I have seen God do in the past, it really wasn't that big a surprise, because God was.
But to me,
giving me what I needed. And that's what at that day, that's exactly what I needed. Well, I needed to hear those old praise songs.
To me, that's just evidence that God really cares for the individual. To think you would get a cassette tape in prison and brought you back to those days when the Lord was really the kind of the springtime of your faith and all.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes. It was.
Wow.
It was.
What would you say to someone who's listening to this show right now, and they're in the depths of, they feel there's no answer, they're just right where you were? What advice would you give them right now?
I would just say that there's no depths that you can go to. There's nowhere that you can fall to, that Jesus won't come and pick you up out of that muck and dust you off and make you brand new again.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I want to sing you a little chorus. I found this saying in the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, 14. It says, "Awake, O sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." And Paul was quoting something, because he said, "It says," and he quoted this verse. And I began to study it. And most scholars think somebody in the early church wrote this song. This is one of the first poems written by just a regular person in a church somewhere in the early church. So I took that verse, and I wrote an extra chorus and verse to it.
Awake, O sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. The night is ending, the day looms ahead, for Christ will shine on you. Christ will shine on you. Christ will shine on you. Away with the darkness, away with the night, and Christ will shine on you. The people who sat in the darkness saw a light comes shining through. And what might that be but the Lord? It is He who shines his light on you. Christ will shine on you. Christ will shine on you. Away with the darkness, away with the night, and Christ will shine on you. Christ will shine on you. Christ will shine on you. Away with the darkness, away with the night, and Christ will shine on you. Yes, Christ will shine on you.
That's our show for tonight. I hope you all have a great Easter weekend celebrating the resurrection of our Lord. God bless.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing.